The Wolf Allegiance had broken through the police line, and now they were swarming down the hill. Some of the crowd stood their ground, including Amadou. Most scattered, pushing past Eliza. Her coat was ripped from her shoulders. A heavy hand landed between her shoulder blades, shoving her down to her knees. Then someone else grabbed her, and she was dragged away by her shoulders. Her heart was thudding too violently for her to summon a scream. She began to fight back, twisting her body to make herself more difficult to drag. A growl of frustration left her throat. Shut up. She was dragged a little farther to the shelter of an oak and thrust aside. She was left panting on her hands and knees, her hair falling in tangles around her face. Just a breath, then another. Then she'd scramble to her feet and run. The knees of her jeans were torn. She could feel the stickiness of blood where both her knees had been skinned. Someone reached down to grab her under the arms and set her upon her feet.
I told you not to come tonight.
Maxime spit the words at her. Eliza combed her hair away from her face with her fingers, staring up at him, white-faced and angry. He was breathing heavily, his torch discarded, his hair disheveled, his polo shirt covered in grass stains, a thin line of blood trailing from the corner of his mouth. His blue eyes were blazing with emotion. His hands clutched Eliza's by the wrists. Behind them, the police had begun to impose some order on the scene, Lemaire barking out instructions. She couldn't see Amadou anywhere, her breath catching on a sob.
Stop it. Maxime snapped. You're fine. You're safe. Everyone's going home.
Why did you come tonight? She snapped back. What kind of monster are you? We haven't even buried our dead, and this is what you thought you'd do?
I don't owe you an explanation, bitch. This is still a free country.
She shook off his grip, twisting around for a better vantage point from which to view the park. The police had arrested several of the stragglers, but in the dark, she couldn't make out who they were. Seher was no longer at the gate. She'd reached Khattak and Rachel, neither of whom seemed happy to see her, yet Khattak held out his hand and pulled her close.
Who the fuck are you in love with?
Maxime's crude words broke through her reverie.
Amadou or that fucking cop?
She turned to face him, squaring her shoulders, a belligerent tilt to her chin. Compared to the emptiness she'd felt before, she welcomed the fury brought on by his words.
Neither. But a frat boy like you wouldn't understand that my world doesn't revolve around a man.
I saw the way you looked at him over by the gate.
Her eyes narrowed.
You were watching me? You're such a creep, Maxime.
That's the thanks I get for dragging you out of that mess?
The mess you made.
She pointed out.
Whatever.
He wasn't able to conceal his hunger as he looked her over. She brushed the dirt and grass from her palms, both her knees still stinging. Before she'd learned about his connection to the wolves, they had been friends. But once she'd understood his views, once Eliza had made it clear that even friendship wasn't possible as long as Max was allied with the wolves, something inside Max had curdled into this hate-tinged lust. He couldn't stand himself for wanting her, but he also couldn't stand to let her go.
Why do you want me, Max? I'm no different from the people you came here to harass, the people you're probably happy were killed at the mosque last night.
Where do you get off making assumptions like that?
Though his eyes and voice had darkened, she wasn't afraid of him. She pointed to the logo on his chest.
Your actions speak for themselves.
She didn't know why she was engaging in this pointless conversation. She should be with the others, searching for Amadou. Issa had moved away, scanning the perimeter. She knew he was looking for her. She put up a hand and waved to let him know she was fine. The sight of Maxime Thibault at her side seemed to give him pause. He started in her direction. A sudden warm glow flared up in her chest. Maxime jabbed a finger in her face.
I never took you for a whore.
She slapped him without a second thought.
Don't. ever call me that.
Disgusted, she added,
It's all the same with your kind. You hate minorities, you hate women, you hate anyone who won't bow to your toxic creed.
He stood there silently, his hand pressed to his face. She must have caught him off guard. He didn't move, didn't try to touch her or hit her back. Not that she would have let him. Her hands were curled into fists, and she was poised on the balls of her feet. She knew how to take care of herself.
It's not about hate, he told her coldly. We have the right to defend ourselves and the Quebec we want, before our culture and history are swept away by the tide.
His hand was still pressed to his cheek, lightly patting the place she'd slapped him. And though Eliza despised Maxime, she felt a pang of pity as she understood why. She hadn't really hurt him. She couldn't. The slap was the first time she'd touched him. Then Issa was there, interposing himself between Eliza and Max, ice in his voice as he asked Maxime what he'd done.
Did you assault her?
Maxime shrugged.
She'll probably tell you I did.
Eliza shot him a furious glare.
I'm not a liar, Max.
He didn't hurt me, she told Issa. He dragged me out of the way. His voice clipped with anger. Issa warned.
Please find Amadou and go back to your residence. This is no place for you.
Then, with a little less control, he said,
I told you to stay at the gate, Eliza. Don't make it hard for me to do my job.
She battled an unexpected response to his concern. She read it as proprietary. From Maxime's expression, he did as well.
I was trying to get to Max, she said. I thought he might listen to me.
Behind her, Max snorted. He kicked at the grass, dislodging a little clump. He scowled at Khatak.
Look as she twists us around. You, me, Amadou. God knows which one of us she wants.
Her cheeks flushed under Issa's steady regard. She glanced at Max, reading the sullen longing in his eyes. She couldn't keep herself from feeling sorry for him, but she couldn't do anything about it. His unsolicited feelings were not her problem. His hate-fueled politics were. If she owed Max anything at all, she would have told him the truth. She'd lost the man she wanted. She would never get him back.
Chapter 38. There was no amount of damage control the mayor could do that would be enough now. The vigil had gone just about as badly as Rachel had anticipated, and the fallout would dominate the next news cycle. The Premier, the Inset team, and the Wolf Allegiance were under fire to varying degrees. It was rumored that the Prime Minister would be visiting Saint-Isidore to pay his respects at the mosque, creating additional security problems for Le Maire's team to manage. No progress had been made on the firearms or on the investigation. As a result, Rachel was surprised that Le Maire hadn't been summarily removed from his post, but judging from his discussions on the phone, he wasn't going down without a fight. There were a handful of police officers left in the park, keeping an eye out for signs of disturbance. While Le Maire was on the phone, Khatak was in the unenviable position of defending his actions to two angry women at once, Diana Shahada and Isabelle Clément. Rachel waited for him, her arms crossed under her chest, ready to step in if he needed backup. She was expecting a moment of reckoning from him, not knowing what Seher might have said. She couldn't ask her either, because Seher had returned to the hotel, finding herself in Issa's way in the midst of the ongoing debriefing. Rachel hadn't had a chance to talk to her yet, and was still puzzling over whether Seher's arrival had made any difference to Khatak. He wasn't on the defensive speaking to the two women. Rather, he sounded like he was on the attack.
There should have been stronger measures against the Allegiance from the start. That was my recommendation to the Premier.
Diana Shahada waved at the mess left behind in the park.
Don't try and cover your inadequacies. If this is your idea of serving the community, no wonder you've been a disappointment.
I'll speak to you in a moment, Diana. Isabel, the only appropriate response is to shut down the allegiance at once.
Isabel's response was as dispassionate as Rachel had grown to expect. She let her eyes trail over the now destroyed memorial for the victims, the wholesome signs trodden by angry feet, flowers and stuffed toys scattered over the grounds.
Inspector Lemaire gave clear instructions to members of his team that should have been enough to handle the situation.
They were protecting these murderers, Diana interjected. They weren't here for the people who came here to pray.
The prayer was a provocation.
Diana's laugh was bitter.
It seems to me in La Belle Provence it's our existence that's the provocation.
Issa turned on Diana again.
This isn't helping. Can you wait for me by your car?
Why? So you can cover this up? I don't think so, Issa. I'm here to watch exactly how effective you are.
He shrugged one shoulder, a rudely dismissive gesture.
Sweet holy Christ. What the hell was Hattuck doing?
Rachel cleared her throat, intending a reminder that he needed to play fair. He shot her a glance, bleak and resonant with anger. She swallowed a hasty response. His jaw set, he said to Isabel,
"The mayor's office issued the permit for the congregational prayer. Surely you knew that?"
Isabel's gaze flicked to Diana Shahada.
"It was my understanding that the permit was granted under considerable pressure."
Hattuck's response slashed the sudden silence.
"Inspector Lemaire did not instruct his team to shrink the perimeter around the prayer. Someone else is responsible for that."
His green eyes were shrewd and insistent. There was a protracted pause. Finally, Clément admitted,
"Thibault threatened to release a statement to the press declaring our decision to squash his protest as unconstitutional."
She moistened dry lips.
"He didn't just argue for freedom of assembly. He insisted it was an issue of freedom of expression. He said that Quebecois values were being dragged back into the Dark Ages."
Hattuck's expression became set. He ignored the group of girls who had come up behind them to clear the litter from the ground. Isabel's gaze flicked over them and back to Hattuck.
"And you gave in to them, just like that."
Her response was pure vitriol.
"Are you saying I shouldn't have offered reasonable accommodation? Isn't that what you always demand?"
Diana sputtered with rage.
"How dare you say that? How dare you wield civil rights protections on behalf of out-and-out Nazis?"
Hattuck held up a hand and was ignored by both women. Isabel's reply was icy.
"My concern is to represent all the citizens of Quebec, not just a group of special interests. I'm sorry if that offends you."
Her expression made it clear she wasn't sorry in the least.
"Sometimes the truth is hard to hear, but there are no safe spaces in politics."
Her tone became sneering, the words directed at Hattuck.
"Nor in police work either, I'm afraid."
She stalked away from them to issue instructions to the girls who were trying to repair the memorial. The Lilies of Anjou had come to the vigil, Rachel realized with a start. She had last seen them at the press briefing on Youssef Soufiane's death. She was surprised that only a few hours later, Chloe had found the strength to make her way to the memorial. Chloe and the other Lilies were joined by Amadou Duchamp, whom Isabelle Clément skirted as if he posed a danger to her. She moved closer to Chloe, and to Rachel's surprise, she gave the younger woman a hug. Perplexed, Rachel noticed that Amadou was whispering earnestly and at length with Émilie Péladeau. From his body language, he was trying to persuade her of something. Lemaire rejoined their group. He didn't seem fazed by the dressing down he'd just received from the premier's office. Maybe such things were as commonplace in the Sûreté as they were in community policing. Hattuck's new phone made the sound that heralded a text.
Instead of reading it, he beckoned them close and held up the phone. They gathered in a circle as Khattak pulled up the text for them to read. "Sufyan is dead. One of you will be next." He took a screenshot of the message, then handed his phone to Lemaire.
"What the hell is happening here?"
Diana Shahada's horrified gaze moved from face to face, but none of the police officers could offer a cogent answer in the face of so many unknowns. Khattak's phone sounded again. This time, Lemaire held up the message. "Richard is about to blow the roof off your world. Vive la France. Vive le Québec libre." Speaking through gritted teeth, Diana demanded, "Inspector Lemaire, can we expect that you'll take some action to defuse another incident like tonight's?" Lemaire nodded. His evident sympathy seemed to infuriate her further.
"I came to tell you that the mosque has been cleared for use. There won't be a repeat of tonight. The mosque is easier to defend."
The terse, pragmatic words sent a shiver down Rachel's spine. How could they be speaking of a place of worship like this? Khattak jerked his head at Lemaire.
"I'll head there now." He addressed Diana. "Come with me and we can talk."
Lemaire nodded. "I'll pass your phone on to your man Gaffney. I've also had a call about security footage. We may have just gotten a lead."
He turned to Rachel.
"It's late, and you need a break. I can catch you up in the morning."
It was true. Rachel was exhausted, but there was too much adrenaline pumping through her veins. With a subtle gesture of her chin, she urged Khattak to take note of Amadou and Emily. They'd moved away from Isabelle Clément, who was frowning at them over Chloe's shoulder. Khattak nodded once.
"Amadou," he called. "We're headed to the mosque. Would you like to join us?"
With a grimace of relief, Amadou removed Emily's hand from his arm. He detached himself from the group without another word. Rachel moved away with Lemaire back to the station. Something about the entire tableau had disturbed her, and it wasn't the naked threat that had surfaced on Khattak's phone.
Chapter 39. Diana Shahada drove, Khattak in the passenger seat, Amadou in the back of the car, his head resting on the arm he'd braced against the window.
"You didn't do enough," Diana told Khattak. "They're running roughshod over you over what you're supposed to achieve. When they called you in to head up community policing, I thought at last we'd have a voice." She shot him an angry glance as she made a right turn. "But having you here is no different from not having you here." He fought himself for a brief moment. He'd stayed silent too often in the past, and now the rage that simmered beneath his composure was threatening to overcome him. He held it back until she added, "The one thing I've never been able to tell about you is where your loyalties lie. What good are you to us when you're always performing for them?" She spoke as though there weren't a third person in the car, a witness to the crime, an individual who was implicated in events, though Khattak didn't know to what extent. His temper snapped.
"I'm sick to God of answering that question. It's not a performance."
Diana snorted.
"Oh, yes, it is. You perform for us, but time after time you end up disappointing the audience."
This was so manifestly unjust that Khattak needed a moment to respond. How had he ever imagined that he and Diana were partners, that they'd ever been on the same side? He shook his head, angry, rattled.
"It doesn't work, Diana. These categories you try to box us into, us, them, it doesn't work. Chloe Villeneuve, she's devastated by Youssef's death. She loved him."
He indicated Amadou, listening intently in the back seat.
"Amadou and Emily, there's something there as well. And even someone like Max is able to see Aliza as a person. We're not on opposite sides because of who we are.
That kind of thinking is reductive.
He clasped his hands together because he wanted to strike something hard.
It's completely dishonest.
He shifted in his seat to look at Amadou.
Isn't that right, Amadou?
The young man's expression was curiously defenseless.
You want to know about Emily?
She seemed angry at you in the park.
They had reached the mosque. He motioned to Diana that she should go ahead without them, passing her the keys to the door. He lingered with Amadou near the car, not yet ready to read the secrets of the mosque.
No, not angry.
Amadou tipped back his beautifully shaped head, his eyes as large and inky as the night.
Emily is a very nice girl. She's always been so supportive. She knows what it's like to be an outsider. She told me she could see it in my face.
See what?
Khatak kept his voice soft and low, his anger at Diana fading at the rhythmic cadences of Amadou's voice.
What it's like not to belong, to keep trying and failing because the barriers that surround you are too strong, too insurmountable.
He reached over to pat Issa's shoulder.
You must know what that's like. So does Diana. That's why she's so angry.
Khatak sighed. The brotherhood Amadou was offering wasn't one he had any right to claim. The systemic barriers faced by Amadou as a black man, the ever-present aggressions that battered each corner of his identity, were daily injuries he and Diana didn't share. Searching for the right words, he said,
Not like you. Nothing like you, Amadou.
Well,
there was nothing Amadou could add. They both knew it was true.
What did Emily want from you then?
The young man's muscles tightened.
She wants something she cannot have. She wants my love. She believes she can save me from the ugliness here by giving me the gift of her love. I have become her project.
There was no contempt in his voice, just a soft, regretful sadness for a girl who'd misunderstood and whose unacknowledged advantages had caused her to lose her way.
You're not interested?
Khatak wondered if Amadou realized he was being led through an interrogation. He wondered if he should remind him that it was his job to hunt down the person who had carried out the killing spree at the mosque. Amadou switched to French, his words caressing the night.
I want to marry a girl from Senegal, a girl with rich, dark skin and eyes as deep as the ocean, a girl I can take to the mosque who will stand by my side in prayer. She will speak my language and know my history. I won't have to build a wall. I won't have to tear one down. I want a woman who shares the journey I make to my sustainer.
A sweet smile graced his lips. Ruefully, he said,
I am engaged to be married to a woman like that. Emily is very kind, very sweet. I value her as a friend without wishing for anything more. Yusuf was willing to take that risk, but I want a woman who knows what it is to live in two worlds at once.
The poetic words made an impression on Khatak. They mirrored the relationship he'd had with his wife, Samina, who, even after her death, held a closely guarded place in his heart, the heart he had only recently opened to Seher.
Does Emily know that?
Amadou sighed.
She knows, but she hasn't accepted it. She keeps trying to change my mind. I don't mean to be unkind, but she is using the shooting as a means of insinuating herself into my life. I don't want it. I don't think she realizes how dangerous it is for us both.
His attention flagged. Khatak asked,
What do you mean? What danger does Emily represent?
Amadou's reply was succinct.
The danger of a white woman involved with a black man, a Muslim, in a town like Saint Isidore. Plus, she's on the radar of Thibault and his thugs. They used to be friends with the Lilies, so they'll never be able to accept Emily's attraction to me. They might call me names. The names they call her are worse.
Amadou didn't want to enter the mosque with Issa. It was too soon for him to face the reality that he hadn't saved Yusuf after all. Issa let him walk away, thinking over his words. Something Amadou had told him was nagging at him, some casual statement that was more important than it had seemed at the time. It needed attention, yet it wasn't coming into focus. But Diana was waiting inside. He wasn't sure she deserved it, but he knew he had to apologize, to defuse a situation that was adding unwarranted pressure to his investigation. The shooter hadn't come to the vigil, but someone had been close by. Diana hadn't disappeared into the women's prayer space. Issa found her in the main hall, arranging a copious scarf over her hair and shoulders. She was quiet, her anger calmed, her head bowed as she waited near the mihrab. When she glanced his way, he was startled to observe that tears had streaked her face, tears she made no effort to wipe away.
"How are we going to solve this?" she asked Issa.
Feeling strangely vulnerable, he answered,
"We'll make progress, Diana. There's bound to be a break in the investigation. We'll find him."
She shook her head.
"I don't mean the investigation."
She stepped forward, her hands tracing over the bullet holes in the mihrab.
"I mean this. How are we going to solve this?"
The grief he'd been suppressing rose up in a wave. An electric silence fell between them, and in it, everything changed. She wasn't his enemy, trying her best to bring him down. She wasn't sitting in judgment, waiting for him to fail. She was someone who'd worked tirelessly for a decade, pushing back against forces that were shrinking the perimeters of her world, the gray zone between forces so bleak and powerful that the simplest act could undo the safety of the bonds that held them, shared values, a shared humanity, citizenship. No one on the outside could appreciate the way that each corner of that safety was threatened. He pressed a fist to the center of his chest, fighting back the emotion that threatened to betray him. Diana watched him, her shadowed eyes vulnerable, her shoulders stooped under the weight of this calamity. She wasn't as redoubtable as he'd always known her to be. She looked small and bereft, mourning what had been and everything that was yet to be lost. She knew this was just the beginning, just as Issa did. He reached out and took her hand, leading her to a spot in the prayer hall. New carpets had been laid over where old ones had been stripped away. He didn't stand in front of her. He left a gap and took a place at her side. He gave the call to prayer, low and rich in his throat, faltering over the words. She rearranged her scarf so that it fell in soft folds from her shoulders to her wrists. When he finished, he turned to Diana, raising his hands to his ears.
"Stand with me," he said.
"In prayer?"
she asked, copying the gesture that opened the rites of prayer.
"No,"
he answered with a searching look.
"Stand with me against this."
Chapter 40. 2 days later, they were no further forward, and night was falling again.
"What are we going to do about these threats?" Rachel asked.
Lemaire rubbed the back of his head in response. He looked like he knew she wasn't going to like his answer.
"You should understand we get things like this all the time. Racist abuse, threats, online and on campus, they're quite common. They're pranks, Rachel. They're meant to distract us from our work."
This feels different, she pointed out. It's someone who's been shadowing Inspector Khattak.
Her glance took in the inset team. It lingered on a couple of Sûreté officers near the photocopier, who'd taken a break and were now observing their boss. The hum of activity around them continued, a buzz that was comforting and familiar. Again, she had the feeling that something about Lemaire's words didn't quite fit in with her picture of events, or with the urgency of the shooting. They were in the office he was using as his own, a few framed photographs on the wall. It was nothing like Richard's vanity wall, though she saw a photograph similar to the one Khattak had described. Lemaire, Clément, and the mayor of Saint-Isidore offering Richard the key to the city. A little shock of alarm ran through her veins. She knew what it was that had tingled at the edge of her consciousness. She pinned Lemaire with a rock-steady gaze.
You're a senior homicide cop? She confirmed. He nodded, watching her. Regularly seconded to inset?
Lemaire shrugged his massive shoulders. I have a certain expertise. What's your point?
She didn't look away.
Then why are you in Saint-Isidore so often?
She nodded at the photograph on the wall.
Why were you and Isabel invited to participate in a ceremony glorifying Pascal Richard, of all people? Doesn't seem to fit within the ambit of homicide or of national security.
Lemaire turned to look at the photograph behind his head. When he turned back, there was something new in his expression. Weighing. Watchful. A thrill of fear whispered down her spine. The desk was between them, but suddenly she felt his towering presence like a threat. He cracked his knuckles on the desk, the sound filling the silence. In a soft voice, he asked,
What are you accusing me of, Rachel? Be specific.
Rachel edged closer to the door. Lemaire stepped around the desk, cutting off her access to the door. Rachel refused to retreat. Her hand thumbed the phone in her pocket. Discreetly, she tapped Khattak's number. Lemaire was too quick for her, his eyes darting to the hand she'd stuffed in her pocket. He fished her phone from her pocket and tossed it onto the desk. His laser blue gaze unwavering, he said,
Go on. You have nothing to fear from me.
Rachel threw up her head.
Why? Because I'm old stock? I'm what you'd call pure laine? Québécois de souche?
Don't be ridiculous, he batted back. You may speak French, but you certainly can't claim to be a Québécois.
Rachel didn't want to, but she had to think of something. Her gaze slipped to the gun he had holstered at his hip. He'd have to get her out of the station to his car. She had a very brief window in which to attempt an escape.
Rachel.
His exasperated tone put an end to her plotting, suggesting she'd overreacted. Why do you think I was at the ceremony? Why do you think that photograph is on the wall?
It's not just the ceremony, she said rapidly.
She jammed her free hand into the pocket of her slacks, withdrawing a crumpled sheet of paper. She held it up as if she were warding Lemaire off with a talisman.
You've made it clear that you're familiar with what's been happening here. You've visited Saint-Isidore several times, yet you've taken zero action on things that should have been dealt with a long time ago.
She brandished the list she'd gotten from the university. He took it from her hand, reading it over with a frown. Rachel barreled ahead.
I can't think of a single reason why a senior homicide officer would be on call here, and then having come, why he'd do nothing to halt the activities of a group like the Wolf Allegiance. You didn't detain Père Etienne, and though you should have detained members of the Allegiance, you haven't even bothered to question them.
Lemaire smoothed out the list, resuming his watchful manner. She hadn't yet said what he seemed to expect her to say. Since she couldn't break past him to the common area, there was no point in holding back.
A lot of people in law enforcement don't seem to have noticed, but Superintendent Killiam did. She told me to watch for it.
Lemaire's eyes didn't shift from her face.
For what?
For proof that all levels of law enforcement have been infiltrated by the far right, the alt-right, white nationalists, dress it up however you want, you're just neo-Nazis in the end.
To say she was stunned when Lemaire began to laugh was putting it mildly. He shifted away from the door with a flourish of his hand, seating himself at his leisure, his shoulders rumbling with laughter.
What?
Still smiling, he said, "The way you glare at me, mon ami, you have quite a way with your superiors."
"You're saying I'm wrong?"
Her heart was thundering in her chest. She flung the door wide, but didn't leave.
"You're not the head of the allegiance? You didn't orchestrate Saint-Isidore's code of conduct with the mayor and Clément?"
Lemaire shook his head, his shaggy hair falling around his collar. "I thank you for that sterling assessment of my character, but no. Take a seat, and I'll tell you, since you seem to have guessed quite a bit." Rachel hesitated, looking at the door. "It's up to you, Rachel. You're perfectly safe working at my side." Mumbling under her breath, Rachel took the seat across from Lemaire. He rested his elbows on the desk, studying the suspicion in her face. "You are quite correct in assessing the problem in Saint-Isidore. There has been infiltration. Some elements of the police force here are suspect. We do have reason to suspect the mayor of giving carte blanche to certain disruptive elements in town."
"The Wolf Allegiance," Rachel supplied.
"The Allegiance," he agreed. "But also others. I was assigned to the Gatineau area to root those elements out, to get a sense of the scope of the problem."
"Why should I believe you?"
"You can check with Superintendent Killiam. She's the one who sent me." As a tide of color swept up Rachel's cheeks, Lemaire sought to put her at ease. "Isabelle's excuse is more innocent. She has family in Saint-Isidore." A low groan escaped Rachel's throat. Lemaire wouldn't have mentioned the superintendent unless he had the bedrock certainty that she would back him up. She'd made a dreadful mistake, and it was one she couldn't back away from. She felt sick with mortification, itchy and uncomfortable in her light summer clothes, under a layer of sweat. At a loss for words, she whispered,
"But why haven't you done anything?"
She made a floundering gesture with her hand.
"Why did you let it go so far?"
Lemaire's shoulders slumped. For the first time, his bright blue gaze dropped from hers, but he didn't attempt to shield himself. "Our inactivity was meant to draw them out, to see who might be fueling the fire behind the allegiance and what their ultimate goal might be. Someone is making use of these kids, radicalizing a new generation, indoctrinating them into extremist ideology."
"So that's why you appeared to give your sanction to Richard. That's why the photograph is here. You were trying to suggest that you're not someone they need to worry about."
"You seem familiar with the photograph."
"Inspector Hattak described it to me. He said he saw a copy of it in Richard's office."
"Ah." He came to a decision, his voice freshening as he addressed her. "Obviously, we failed at our task. We were unprepared for action. I had to limit my visits here so as not to raise suspicions. That's how I missed the signs." Rachel nodded to herself. Lemaire's explanation was plausible, but she would still be confirming it with the superintendent.
"You mean the break-in at the MSA's office?"
"That. But there was a more obvious clue."
Puzzled, Rachel stared at him.
She still had only the blurriest impression of what had happened in Saint-Isidore before the shooting. "The broken light outside the women's entrance to the mosque," Lemaire explained. "Someone did a trial run to see how easy it would be to gain entrance without fear of discovery. That's why they vandalized the light."
And you didn't think to put up your own cameras after that?
Rachel's tone was accusing. We were being careful. We didn't want to tip them off. Rachel frowned to herself. Had it simply been the wrong call? Because its consequences had spun rapidly out of control, and she could see that the truth had just come home to hit Lemaire. Rachel put in a quick call to Superintendent Killiam to confirm Lemaire's information. When she aired her suspicions, Killiam once again took the time to reassure her about Lemaire's skills and reputation. Rachel hung up, still uncertain. A hand rapped on the door. It was Constable Benoit, an anxious expression on his face, as if it had taken all his courage to interrupt. Though Rachel was glad of the reprieve, she felt sorry for him. She knew what it was like to be that young and green.
We have something, sir. Would you like, that is, are you available to see the footage?
The glimmer of a smile in his eyes, Lemaire turned to Rachel.
Are we?
She swallowed a sarcastic retort, following him to Benoit's station, where a group of officers were gathered. Her colleague Paul Gaffney was among them, and she smiled a welcome at him. It was good to have someone else from community policing with them, someone she knew she could trust. Gaff nodded at her.
Benoit is the one who spotted it. I just cleaned it up.
The attention of everyone gathered at the desk was fixed on Benoit's monitor. At a nod from Lemaire, Benoit hit the play button. The footage was from a small shop 2 streets west of the mosque. Its shady, tree-lined lane was dark, save for a single street lamp. For 15 seconds, the street was deserted on both sides. Then a figure passed directly under the street lamp, pausing for the briefest moment. The figure pivoted, casting a glance over its shoulder, facing the camera head-on. Ice-cold dread froze in Rachel's veins. The figure was a woman wearing a niqab and an abaya. When she turned toward the camera and raised her arm, something else became clear. The woman was carrying a gun. Rachel held her breath, her heart kicking painfully at the walls of her chest. Her panicked eyes sought Lemaire's. What the hell did this mean? Lemaire rattled off a volley of remarks in French, directing his subordinates to keep a tight lid on the evidence and Benoit to turn over the footage without making a copy. They established a chain of custody, Benoit passing the footage over to Lemaire in a signed and dated envelope. Both Benoit and Gaffney co-signed the seal of the envelope.
It is essential that this doesn't leak to the media.
One of Lemaire's subordinates spoke up.
Where do we direct our efforts now? It seems we've been wasting our time looking beyond the mosque.
Finish the intake on those who were at the vigil tonight.
But, sir—
Do it, Lemaire snapped. I'll take care of this.
Lemaire's team scattered back to work. Rachel hung back with Gaffney while Lemaire stormed into his office and slammed the door. Through the glass panels, she could see he'd taken out his phone and was shouting at someone on the other end. His personality was volatile and intriguing. She much preferred Khattak's enlightened calm, but she couldn't deny that Lemaire's presence was exciting.
You planning to stick around? Gaff asked. I'm knocking off for the night.
Rachel sank down lower and whispered,
Is that really the only copy of the footage?
Gaff grinned at her, gathering his things and shoving his laptop back into its bag.
Are you kidding me? The boss told me to run my inquiries separately from Inset's, just in case. He's not as enamored of Lemaire as you are.
Enamored?
Rachel's protest sounded like a squawk. Gaff walked her out to the parking lot.
Never seen you so hot and bothered, not even over that gentleman who couldn't make up his mind.
Rachel shrugged, pretending that she didn't know he was describing Nate. But Gaff knew her well enough to tease her. She'd left her phone on Lemaire's desk and thought about going back to get it. But at Gaff's knowing grin, she changed her mind. She needed a few hours of sleep. Gaff could give her a ride, and then he could bring Hattak up to speed.
You don't have to leave because I am. I'm guessing old Blue Eyes is quite the antidote to your need for regular sleep.
A reluctant smile cracked her face. Shut up and drive, she said.
Chapter 41. Issa was beginning to feel like he had sandpaper under his eyelids. He'd been working the case around the clock, barely speaking to Seher. Lemaire had returned his phone, and now a message came through from Rachel. He rubbed at his eyes, the thick lashes tangling, reading over her request. He was aching with fatigue, and he wanted to get back to the hotel to see Seher, the one bright spot in this darkness. But she would have gone to bed by now, so he might as well see what Rachel wanted.
You need to see this footage, somewhere away from the eyes of Lemaire and his team. Meet me at this address in 15.
He checked the address with the GPS on his phone. Rachel had chosen a spot on the north side of the lake, a few miles beyond the Université Marchand. There were probably several cafes open late near the university. He drove through the streets slowly, conscious that he was not as alert as he needed to be to drive. The drive around the lake was circuitous. It was also exceptionally scenic. The antique street lamps hung with flowering baskets that spilled waves of pink and crimson against a backdrop of trees. The lake itself lay black and silver under the moon, its soft waves dipping to a rhythm that soothed the turmoil of his senses as he rolled down his window to take in the breeze. As it stirred the hair across his forehead, some of his tension eased. He thought he glimpsed a little white boathouse across on the opposite bank, and instantly he was transported back to the town of Waverly and the shores of White Pine Lake, to appear in the dead of night where he'd stood over the resting place of a fiercely determined young woman. He was saddened by the memory of her loss. But that there was too much death in his life wasn't the issue. He'd known that would be the case when he'd committed himself to the police. What troubled him more deeply than he was able to express was that there was so little justice. He took a turn away from the lake and back into the heart of the town, to quiet streets away from the residential neighborhoods, down a road that led to a series of abandoned lots, derelict and overgrown in the sumptuous summer heat. Tiger lilies sprawling in wild, corrosive bunches, tangled with the lacy heads of weeds. There were no cafes on this road, nor any indication that Rachel was somewhere nearby. They could have met in the hotel lobby. That she'd chosen such a faraway spot suggested that she'd stumbled onto something too provocative to share with Lemaire. Hattak parked on the street, gazing around for some sign of Rachel's car. The address she'd given him was for a small brown building whose windows were boarded up. The street number was stamped on a listing sign that would soon crash down from the lintel it was loosely attached to. A strong gust of wind would free it. Its serrated edge looked dangerous. Hattak ducked under it, frowning. There was no sign of Rachel having passed this way, which seemed a little strange in itself. He let his hand drop from the door to seek out his phone. He put a call through to Rachel. His frown deepened when he heard the muffled sound of her ringtone from somewhere inside the building. She didn't answer. He tried again, and the phone rang in the silence. His sense of danger sharpened. He reached for his gun only to remember that he'd locked it in the glove box of his car. He'd had a presentiment that if he'd gone to the vigil armed, he would be laying the groundwork for a tragic confrontation. He had started back to his car when he heard a shuffling sound on the other side of the door, followed by a low moan. He tried the doorknob, and the door parted from its frame with a groan. "Rachel, are you in there?" It was utterly dark inside, a blankness that disoriented. He smelled something, sharp, unpleasant.
Was it blood? His hand felt for the flashlight in his pocket, his steps advancing bit by bit. He found the edge of a wall and followed it deeper into the building.
Rachel?
He called again. Something was wrong. He flicked on the flashlight. His wavering steps had led him to a small, dark, windowless room. His light flickered into its deepest corners, and he was met by a sight that froze him where he stood, motionless and fully alert to danger and to the recklessness that had made him come this far alone. He didn't have time to reconsider. As his flashlight made another sweep of the room, he was struck on the back of his head. When he woke again, there was a musty thickness in his mouth. A roll of cloth had been stuffed inside it, not far enough to cause him to choke, just enough to keep him quiet. Blearily, his eyes opened. His flashlight had rolled onto the floor a short distance away. A small circumference of light spooled out near his feet. After a moment's blurry reflection, he realized he was sitting in a metal chair, his feet bound to its legs, his hands bound with a plastic tie behind his back. He could feel a stickiness at the back of his neck where blood had dripped into his collar. He couldn't see anyone or hear anything beyond the frenzied beating of his heart. Questions filled his mind. Where was he? Who had done this? Was Rachel somewhere safe? He was bound too tightly to shift his position, but he did his best to turn his head. Behind him, someone had made an effort to disperse the gloom by lighting a single candle. He blinked, trying to clear his vision. Memory came back in a flash. He'd seen this when he'd entered the room. A man in a white robe, wearing a wolf head whose giant fangs were dripping blood. Black letters were slashed across his chest. The Wolf Allegiance. He'd stumbled onto the headquarters of Saint-Isidore's neo-Nazi group. No, that wasn't quite right. His head aching, he forced himself to think, to remember. He hadn't stumbled onto it. He'd been lured here by a text sent from Rachel's phone, and then he'd been attacked. By whom? Maxime Thibault? Or someone associated with him? Someone who knew that Rachel had returned to the station for an update on security footage from the area around the mosque. Pain pounded through his skull. What if Rachel was somewhere nearby? He'd heard her phone ring from inside the building because he'd called it twice. His breathing became panicked. He began to suffocate under the cloth in his mouth. There was a sudden sharp movement from one corner. The candle flame was snuffed out. He heard the snick of a flashlight as the room was plunged into darkness again. A presence moved closer to him, taking him by the jaw and jerking up his head. The roll of cloth was yanked from his mouth. The hand at his jaw dropped, and the presence withdrew. He could hear someone breathing, quick and easy breaths. "Who's there? Who are you?" There was no answer. He tugged wildly at the ties that bound his wrists, cutting them, the spill of blood slickening the friction. There was another sharp movement. A hard blow landed just below his shoulder. "Thibault, is that you?" A thick and black silence settled in his mouth. He could taste it. He felt his adrenaline spike as fear coursed through his body. Again, no one spoke. A hand gripped his throat with a fierce and terrible power, squeezing so hard that Issa couldn't speak, couldn't cry out. The pressure kept on and on until he passed out again. Chapter 42. When he came to, slivers of early light leaked beyond the boarded windows to cast a pale opal glow in the room. Light pulsed behind his eyelids. His body ached from its unnatural posture. He was lying on his side, one of his arms pinned beneath his weight.
He scrambled into a sitting position, a wave of nausea surging in his chest. He fought it, spitting out the bile in his mouth. Pain shot fiery trails up his arm as it was freed from his weight. He flexed his wrists. He was no longer bound, no longer sitting in a chair, his wrists and ankles freed. But blood was caked at his wrists and thickly matted in his hair. He took stock of his injuries, a throbbing pain in his head and a soreness beneath his left shoulder. Other than that, he hadn't been hurt. He staggered to his feet, feeling his head spin, colors bursting behind his eyes. It took several long minutes to steady himself, his breath rasping in his chest. His mind sorted through the various strands of the case, trying to weave them together, trying to remember. He'd come here. Why? What had happened to him? He became aware of a buzzing noise. His hand slipped into his pocket to bring out his phone. There were a dozen messages on it, nearly all of them from Rachel. One from Diana, another from Seher. His vision blurred in and out. He couldn't read them. He stumbled over to a wall and rested his aching head against it, stabbing out numbers on the phone. Rachel answered at once, her words washing over him in a flurry of concern. He didn't know what he was doing in this room or what had happened to him, so he couldn't tell her. He didn't know where he was, so he couldn't give her the address. She told him to leave his phone on and she would track it, trying to make sense of his recital. "Just wait there," she said. "Wait there and don't move a muscle. An ambulance will be there soon." An ambulance? Why would he need an ambulance? Words slurred on his tongue, but Rachel had already hung up. He lurched from the room into an entranceway. He was in some kind of deserted office building, emptied of furniture, in the middle of renovations that had been discontinued abruptly, drywall half erected, timber and rebar shifted off to one side. By gripping the wall, he was able to make his way to the door, an inexplicable sensation of dread mounting in his chest. Something was wrong. Even Rachel's voice had sounded strangely unfamiliar. But outside, it was an ordinary summer day, the breeze moving through the overhanging branches of trees that lined the empty street. He squinted against the light of a pale dawn sky, shivering in the fresh air. He spotted his car in the street and made his way over to it, step by painful step, wondering if he had the keys. His pockets felt strangely light. Something told him he should get inside his car as quickly as he could manage and lock the doors. He should get his gun. But he didn't know why. The car was unlocked. Inside the car, he breathed in great gulps of air. He locked the doors and fumbled for the glove box. It was locked, and he couldn't find the keys. Maybe he'd left them inside, but something told him he shouldn't go back inside. His eyes were dry and gritty, his mouth tasted of something unpleasant, and his wrists were sore and itching under their coating of blood. He looked back at the building, trying to remember. There had been a sign with a number on it. He'd thought at first of an apartment. There should be a message on his phone from Rachel specifying the address. But when he checked back through the log, trying to clear his vision, the message was gone. She'd wanted to meet him there. He looked at the lintel of the building again. There had been footsteps in the dust and a sign above his head. Abruptly, Khatak remembered. He made his way back into the building. He was listening intently, but he knew that the air in the building was different now. It was deserted. He was the only one inside. Nonetheless, he picked up a piece of rebar, holding it up like a weapon. He advanced cautiously to the room he'd been in. Someone had lured him to this building, knocked him out, and trussed him. A candle had been lit to show him a mural on the wall.
the man wearing a wolf's head, and beneath it the name of Maxime Thibault's hate group, the Wolf Allegiance. He entered the room with the rebar in his hand, ready to strike out. But now, the room was empty. Everything that had been in the room was gone. The chair, the candle, the mural on the wall, even his flashlight. Whoever had struck him had vanished. But how could the mural have vanished? Where was the wolf's head with its threatening fangs? He moved closer to the wall and touched it. It was an old cement wall with a layer of dust that hadn't been painted over. There was no trace of stickiness and no chemical scent of paint. Had he imagined it? But how could he have dreamt an image he'd never seen before? He thought back to the polo shirts worn by the Wolf Allegiance at the march. The official symbol of the Allegiance was a man wearing a wolf head, but the marchers had worn a restyled flag of Quebec, emblazoned with the slogan, "Stop the Islamization of Quebec." It occurred to him now that the slogan had been written in English and not in French. He drew the obvious conclusion. The intended audience hadn't been Quebec. The Wolf Allegiance had hoped to broadcast its views to the rest of the country. He tried to refocus. So it hadn't been some kind of elided dream. He'd seen the mural in the light thrown up by the candle. He examined the floor near the wall for traces of fallen wax, but the floor was clean, layers of dust indicating that no one had traveled over this patch. He realized suddenly that his re-entry into the room was contaminating any evidence the forensic team might find. He beat a retreat, his body refusing to move as quickly as his mind commanded. More light was reaching into the room, spreading out from the corners. It was hurting his head, which still throbbed painfully. He needed a wash and a change of clothes and something to eat to combat his sense of weakness. He needed to return Seher's call. He was swept by dizziness again. Dropping the steel bar, he grasped blindly for the wall, his hand landing on the boarded window. He braced himself for long minutes, breathing in deep gulps of air. Close by, he heard a rustle. When the spots in his vision cleared, he realized that something was caught between the boards, a thick, brown envelope. Handcrafted, he realized, assembled from pieces of marbled paper. His first name was typed on the outside of the envelope in a sloping, Italianate font. He left it where it was, though an urgent need to take hold of it possessed him. He could hear the sounds of the ambulance, so he made his way back outside to wait. Rachel jumped out, ahead of the paramedic. Her face paled at the sight of him. He must look worse than he felt. A van pulled up, dislodging members of the crime scene unit he recognized from the mosque. He gave them a series of muddled instructions as the paramedic urged him onto a stretcher. He chafed at the interval while his vitals were taken and a painkiller was administered. The cuts at his wrists were bandaged as Rachel photographed his wrists. Khatak frowned at the sight of her phone. "Is that yours?" he asked, remembering now what had drawn him inside the building. He told her quickly, and she listened, appalled. "I'd left my phone at the station. I picked it up earlier this morning." "Same phone?" She checked it over, going through her camera roll to make certain. "Yes, it's my phone, sir. Why?" Khatak struggled to answer, feeling a strange lethargy steal over his limbs. He was finding it hard to focus. He looked at the paramedic and asked him in labored French, "What did you give me?"
"A sedative. You need it."
Alarm widening his eyes, he struggled to make Rachel understand. About her phone, about the mural, about the envelope pinned to the window. She tried to hush him, to urge him to lie down, but there was something he needed to tell her. He could only manage one word.
"Seher."
He didn't know if he'd made himself understood before he was claimed by sleep. When he woke, he wasn't at the hospital. He was back in his hotel room, lying under the covers on his bed. The curtains on his window were open. It was late in the day. A sleepy twilight had settled over the lake, the clouds tumbling in low, dark clusters reflected in the water. A beautiful, heartbreaking view. He couldn't remember how he'd gotten here. When he tried to sit up, the pain at the back of his head made itself known, a sharp-edged block that weighed him down.
Issa, please don't move.
It was Seher's voice, the desperate concern in it a balm for his troubled thoughts. She was still in Saint-Isidore. He'd been afraid that she'd left, frightened off by the Wolf Allegiance or angry at him for having given her so little of his time. She knelt beside him on the bed, helping to raise him up. She held a glass of water to his lips and urged him gently to drink. Her soft, russet hair fell against his face, and he took a startled breath, inhaling the subtle scent of her, feeling pleasure break over him in waves. Her voice shaky, she said,
"Your mother is terribly worried."
His eyes sought hers, a question in them.
"I didn't tell her. Someone leaked it to the press, so I called to reassure her. Rooksh flew in to make sure their doctors knew what they were doing."
Trying to inject a note of humor into the situation, he asked,
"And did they?"
"You'll be fine," Seher told him.
"But this is your second concussion, so you'll need to take things easy for a while. It's time to let Rachel take the lead."
She was still sitting very close to him, her scent all around him, her skin soft and cool where she was holding his hand. He set the glass aside and kissed her, measuring her ardent response. She drew back after a moment.
"None of that, either. I told you you're supposed to rest."
When she made to move off the bed, he caught her wrist. He didn't want to waste another moment, no matter what the circumstances were. If he stayed at community policing, his work would always be between them. Seher had been holding back, giving him time to make certain that this was what he wanted. He hadn't known how to convince her of his desire to move forward, given their time apart. Now he knew he needed to be bolder. His willingness to be patient had only deepened her doubts. He kissed her again lightly.
"Marry me, Seher," he urged her now. "Don't leave me again."
She freed herself from his hold, going to stand at the window and looking out.
"Rooksh is here, and Rachel. They're waiting in the lobby."
"They're not you, Seher. Don't you know the difference?" She smiled at him over her shoulder, and the sweetness of the smile made the tension in his head subside. She wasn't going to leave. She'd come to Saint-Isidore to stay.
"Do you have an answer for me?"
A hopeful note entered his voice. She swung around to face him.
"Do you have a ring for me?" she teased.
Elation lit his eyes, transforming the bleakness of his expression. His self-restraint vanished.
"Come here, Seher."
She acquiesced, letting him take her in his arms, reaching up to hold him close, her fingertips delicately exploring the contours of his skull. But when she heard the rasp of his breath, she slid through his arms like silk, pulling a chair up to the bed.
"I'm not an invalid," he warned. "I can see that."
That teasing note was still in her voice, sending tremors of delight through his veins.
"Then come back to me. I shouldn't be with you in your room."
It was the only thing she could have said to reawaken his sense of propriety, of boundaries they both observed. She laughed a little when he groaned, and an answering smile lit his eyes.
"Then you'd better marry me quickly, hadn't you?"
She took his hand in hers, tracing the outline of his stitches. His pulse pounded beneath the careful touch.
God, Seher, this is torture.
No, she said huskily. Torture is when you vanish without a word. It's watching Rachel call you and you not answering your phone. It's finding out she's called an ambulance because something terrible has happened. She blinked the tears from her lashes. I'm used to waiting for you, Issa. That doesn't mean I hate it any less. Fear stabbed through his thoughts. Seher had often protested the dangerous nature of his work. It was one of the reasons he was reconsidering his job.
Do you want me to stop what I'm doing? Do you want me to leave this job?
His grave eyes were steady on hers. Seher drew a shaky breath, the sound tearing at his defenses. She reached forward to take his face in her hands, hands that were slender and strong.
You've been asleep most of the day, she said, so you don't know what's happened. You don't know about the leak of the footage or the way that everything's changed, the way they're looking at us now.
She brushed his lips with hers, whispering the words into his mouth.
So no, Issa, I don't want you to stop. I want you to save us all.
Chapter 43. Late in the day, Rachel, Gaffney, and Benoit sat at the desk in Lemaire's office. He'd given up his office to them so they'd have complete privacy to examine the material from the envelope Khattak had found. Lemaire himself had a more imperative concern. Despite his warnings to the contrary, someone on the inside had leaked the footage of the woman in the abaya to Pascal Richard. Richard had not only made the footage available through his blog, he'd made it the only subject on his program. As a predictable result, the tenor of the national response to the shooting had altered, yielding to a firestorm of hate. Lemaire was stuck in meetings addressing this latest crisis. A set of photographs were spread across the desk. They were copies. The originals, along with the envelope they'd been in, were at the lab. Rachel had insisted on receiving copies of the photographs, disturbed by Lemaire's admission about the infiltration of the Sûreté by elements of the far right. The investigation was plagued with additional leaks that made their job much harder. Who was to say that the envelope wouldn't be made to mysteriously disappear? She'd logged it into evidence herself, making sure that both Gaffney and Benoit were in attendance. Now, they studied the photographs together. Benoit's eager desire to please was palpable, whereas Gaffney was merely thoughtful, making observations about the type of lens used and the framing of each photograph, laying out the context clues. His ability to be so calm secretly infuriated Rachel, whose stomach was a twisted mass of worry and suspicion. She'd been popping anti-acid pills to keep a lid on her emotions. She and Khattak had had some bad moments in the past. She expected them as part of her job. But the photographs presented a new and unknown form of menace. She'd waited for Lemaire to act, to respond to Khattak's suggestion regarding the profiler, and when he hadn't, she'd made the decision herself, putting a call through to Superintendent Killiam to get the help she needed, and reiterating to Killiam her theories on Lemaire's reluctance to act. They'd never had an investigation dissolve into shambles like this. They needed immediate course correction, so Rachel had plunged ahead. 2 years, Gaffney said upon a thorough examination of the photographs. Rachel frowned at him, a signal to elaborate.
As best as I can tell, the photographs go back 2 years. Khattak will have to confirm it, of course, but I'd say that's pretty close.
Rachel swallowed, hard. Each photograph on the table depicted a moment in Khattak's life, taken without his awareness. They weren't photographs of his public life, the press conferences he'd given, the accounts of the resolution of various CPS cases, nor even of the Drayton inquiry that had been reported so widely in the press. The photographs were personal, deeply intimate, prying into the corners of Hattak's private life, a grossly personal intrusion. Many were moments Rachel recognized, moments she had been a part of. She ran them down one by one, explaining them to the others. A photograph of Hattak at a bus station. He was standing on the steps of the bus, looking down at a young woman wearing a loose black headscarf, sadness and regret in his eyes.